Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome Jeff Haas. He is a civil rights lawyer who, in 1969, opened the People's Law Office, whose clients included the Black Panthers, SDS, other political activists, the Weathermen, anti-war protesters, and lots of other groups and individuals. And he's the author of the new book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. And he will be reading in Taos at the Mabel Dodge Lujan House on January 15th at 7 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's start off with this quite amazing character, Fred Hampton. Who was he?
Fred Hampton was a young man who grew up in the western suburbs of Chicago. His parents had moved from Louisiana, like many black families, in the 40s, seeking jobs. They ended up working at the Cord and Products Company on the west side of Chicago. And in fact, Fred Hampton's mother babysat for Emmett Till when Emmett Till was a very young boy. And they had similar backgrounds moving to Chicago. Fred was kind of an amazing kid from the get-go. He early on organized a breakfast program in his own community, picking up the kids who were hungry and taking them over to his parents' house on Saturday morning where he would fix breakfast for everybody.
When he himself was still in school.
When he was in school. When Fred got to be in high school, in many ways he was an average kid. He liked sports. He was on the basketball and the football team. But he also had a tremendous drive, a concern about justice and fairness. So early on, one of his first issues was the fact that black girls were not being considered for homecoming queens. He actually led a walkout of the school to protest that. He went from that to demanding black administrators in the school and also programs for blacks who were easily and commonly expelled from schools. This was in the mid-60s. Fred was born in 1948, so it's interesting. His development and the whole development of the black movement were similar, say, between 65 and 69. Fred started demanding more black administrators, somewhat like Huey Newton and Bobby Seale did in California when they were at Merritt College. He went from that. He noticed that there was no swimming pool in Maywood for black kids. White kids could go to a veteran's swimming pool in a nearby suburb. So Fred organized the youth and the young people of the community and demanded a swimming pool in a recreation center. And he led a demonstration to the city council and eventually was successful. Even though Fred couldn't swim, he made this an important issue.
I mean, he was successful in virtually everything he did.
He was a charismatic figure. He had the ability to get people to believe in what themselves and what they could do. And so early on, he led a demonstration to the city council. He actually won over many city council members, including whites, who became his big supporters. At the same time that he was organizing, J. Edgar Hoover in Washington was actually monitoring Fred Hampton. And some documents that have come out even since the book was written show that in 1967, before Fred Hampton even joined the Panther Party, J. Edgar Hoover was giving reports on Fred Hampton, and this march to the city council to demand a recreation center was sent to the White House and the CIA by Hoover personally. Fred continued. Because he was such a good organizer, he was made the head of the NAACP, suburban NAACP of Chicago. And it grew from like 15 to 200 members in the next 6 months. And they continued to work on issues primarily relating to students and fairness in schools. He was also the mediator at his school. The principal would call him in when there was conflicts between the blacks and the whites. And Fred had so much stature and respect that he was able to work out these disputes. In 1967, when Dr. King came to Chicago to attempt to integrate some of the white suburbs, Fred marched with Dr. King. There's a picture of him in the book with Abernathy and Jesse Jackson, who were working with Dr. King at the time. from there, the story I was told was that when Fred was marching, a woman who was marching with him, a black woman, got spit upon by a white woman in the crowd. And Fred said, I'm not just going to take it anymore. And I don't believe in this nonviolent turning the other cheek type of thing. And in fact, Dr. King was not particularly successful in Chicago in getting the very racist suburbs to open up housing to blacks. And I think Dr. King even said, I've never seen so many Nazi flags as when I went to Chicago. From there, Fred was was influenced by the Black Power movement. He opened a Black History section in the library or bookstore in Maywood. And he actually, at one point, when Stokely Carmichael and Rap Brown came to Chicago to speak, and they raised the issue of Black Power, Fred joined with them. In 1969, actually, SNCC and the Panthers joined for a short time, or Stokely joined, and so Fred became the head of the Panthers in Chicago. And his dynamism and his ability to organize resulted in the Panther chapter in Chicago growing tremendously. Men and women, they started a breakfast program. There were no programs for children, mostly in black communities who went to school hungry. The Panthers started a breakfast for children program. They solicited food from the grocery stores and from restaurants, and they served the food. And Fred was not like somebody who just told people what to do. He'd be there at the breakfast program at 5:30 or 6 in the morning, serving breakfast, cooking the food, handing the food out to the kids. We learned later that the FBI had a program called COINTELPRO, and the program targeted the entire black movement. It had targeted Dr. King earlier and attempted to get him to commit suicide by blackmailing him about some tapes. But the Black Panther Party was the real target of Hoover, and he said they were the greatest threat.
What did COINTELPRO stand for?
It stands for Counterintelligence Program, and it was a special secret program that Hoover set up. And in 1967, he sent memos to every FBI office in the country directing them to prevent the rise of a black messiah who could unify and electrify the masses.
This book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton, is absolutely gripping. And one of the things that I find fascinating about it, it's not only the story of Fred Hampton, the FBI, the Chicago police, and so on, and the Black Panther Party, but it's also, to some extent, the story of you and, as a lawyer, your relationship to all of these people in this court case, which we'll talk about in a moment, but also just coming up and coming into this consciousness and the decisions that you made and when you made them. When did you first hear about the term black power?
I heard about it, strangely enough, I guess it was, I think, first stated in 1966. And I graduated, and I heard about it then in a movement term, but in 1967, I graduated from the University of Chicago Law School, where I had a very interesting class. Both Bernadine Dorn, the head of SDS, and John Ashcroft were my classmates. And anyway, I went to get sworn in at the Illinois Supreme Court, and one of the justices got up and started talking to us about the greatest danger and greatest threat to civilization, to human rights and civil rights in this country, and he said it was black power. And so I was a little bit put off by this thing. And, you know, the more I've studied black power, it was much about a way for blacks to organize themselves, to have an effect. Black power came about, you know, after blacks were excluded from the Democratic Party and weren't allowed to be part of the group that sat in Mississippi. So, and it wasn't an attack on whites. And I think particularly when Fred got up, he used to have a saying, it was almost humorous. He said, black power for black people, brown power for brown people, red power for Native American people, white power for white people, and X power for anybody who I haven't included. And he said that sort of jokingly. But anyway, he also had a really good sense of humor. I think some of the early stories about how did Fred get to be such a good speaker and orator, and there were a couple of things that I heard from his family. When he was young, he had a large head related to the rest of his body. And kids used to make fun of him, so he became very good at verbal sparring. And so he was pretty quickly labeled the King of the Nines, which means he could out-talk anybody who tried to talk about your mama and so forth. And so he was very good at that. The other thing is that he had a lisp. And so to overcome that, he taped the speeches of both Malcolm X and Dr. King. And he used to practice them. And one of the people I interviewed said he had memorized almost every speech of both of theirs and could repeat them. So in many ways, he made himself the orator he was. And I think the thing that was so amazing about Fred Hampton, at age 20, he could go to a law school and speak to law students, and he could talk to welfare mothers, and he could talk to kids on the block. And they all would listen to him and be moved by him and inspired by him. And I think that's why he was such a threat.
Why do you think, somebody like him, yes, he was a great organizer and a charismatic person, that was considered a threat, but there's some deeper underlying question that I think needs to be addressed, which is why people like J. Edgar Hoover and the police and so on were so threatened by the very idea of black people having power.
Well, I think there was some misunderstanding, and of course I think many of the police in this country felt it was their duty to basically protect whites from blacks. That was their duty. It was to patrol and militarize the black community. There was also the issue of police brutality, which was very real in Chicago and most cities, and blacks were the victims of that. And the Panthers were very stridently spoke out against police brutality. They organized against it. They talked about community control of police.
I love that action that they did, which was they would follow in their own cars. They would follow police cars around and watch how they did arrests and watch what they did. And when they were followed and monitored like that, which the police hated, there was a lot less brutality.
That's right, that it had an effect. Well, the police didn't like people monitoring, and that's one of the things the Panthers in Oakland did when they got started. So I don't think the police, obviously didn't appreciate that. There was also Panther rhetoric, which was very anti-police. And when they explained it, they'd say, well, we're talking about police who prey on young men in the community. But the rhetoric was off the pig, and so some police took that to mean that they were targets of the Panthers. And so I think in the book I sort of document what some of the incidents that led up to the raid. There were two young black men killed in Chicago by the police who were organizing to try to get a stoplight so that kids in the project could get to the health clinic.
Two brothers.
One was an organizer, and the other one, when the first one was killed in a demonstration, the other one came back from Vietnam to attend the funeral, and then he was killed. And that was only a few weeks before the Hampton raid, and it was also very close to where the Black Panther office was.
Now, the Black Panther offices were raided, and Fred Hampton's house was raided, and he was killed, assassinated, executed at the end of 1969.
Right. The raid itself was, of course, a very big news story in Chicago. On the morning of December 4th of 1969, 14 Chicago police officers assigned to Edward Hanrahan, the prosecutor. They were not under police control, and they were under the prosecutor, who was politically ambitious and was the heir apparent to Mayor Daley at that time. And he had declared a war on gangs and really a war on black kids. And so his men were the ones who carried out this raid. They came to the apartment at 4:30 in the morning with shotguns, a rifle, a machine gun, and handguns. They came in firing, and at the end of it, Fred Hampton was dead in the bed where he was sleeping, and Mark Clark was dead in the front of the apartment. Four of the Panthers were injured, and three were just beaten and were not hit by bullets.
Before that happened, you had been galvanized on the day of Martin Luther King's death and the day after when there was rioting in the streets. You were watching this on television, watching the police pick up basically any black kid who was even so much as in the street, and you got out of your chair, walked out of the house, and said, I'm going to go represent these kids. After that, you became a lawyer who was helping all sorts of people, including the Black Panthers, and you were with Fred Hampton, the day before he was killed?
2 days before he was killed, yeah, or a day and a half, actually, is what it was. You know, the book is a combination of my memoir, my story. How did I come from a upper middle class Jewish family in Atlanta, ending up in Chicago in the tumultuous times of the 60s? And then I stop and I trace Fred's history, both his family from Louisiana and his growing up in the western suburbs and what he encountered, and there's some of this story about high school and how he was an organizer. And for a brief moment in 1969, our lives overlapped, and we became the lawyers for the Black Panthers. The incident you talked about where I and another lawyer went down and defended some of these black kids who were getting picked up was one of the important moments in the formation of the People's Law Office, because I met Dennis Cunningham there, and he was one of the other founders with me and two other lawyers of the People's Law Office. And of course, I do try to tell it like, well, what were the things that moved me, that caused me to change? And some did and some didn't. And I think growing up in the South, being a white person, being somebody who had observed several racist incidents, and I talk about there about going to see the Atlanta Crackers, the all-white team in Atlanta, and not only was the team all-white, but spectators had to sit in different sections. The black people sat in right field up on a hill, and the white people sat in the stands. And it was particularly moving to me, or I guess upsetting, because it was a black man who usually took me and my friend Henry to the baseball games, and he'd have to leave and go sit out in right field. But many of these abuses, I guess myself, like many Southerners, watched. We were upset by them, but we didn't speak out against them. And so I think I carried that when I went to Chicago. All of a sudden, I was in a different environment. And I think the events, the whole black civil rights movement, the black power movement, somewhat changed the way I saw things. Also, being in a sort of white law school in the middle of black Chicago had a big effect on the way I viewed the world.
We're talking to Jeffrey Haas. He is the author of The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. So, December 1969, Fred Hampton was killed. It was a huge story. What was the police version? And did you know immediately that there were problems with their story?
We knew it very quickly. The police version was that they were serving a search warrant, and as they entered, the Panthers opened fire on them. Three different times the police claimed that they said ceasefire, and three different times the Panthers continued firing at the police. So the police version is they were just sort of innocently serving a search warrant. Some even claimed they didn't know it was a Panther apartment, why they would carry a machine gun and three shotguns and a rifle to do, you know, I don't think they think it was grandma not having an unregistered gun under her mattress. It was pretty clear they did, but they at first pretended like they were taken by surprise. They had no idea it was a Panther apartment, and they were opened fire upon. They come back with weapons, and they did find weapons in the apartment, and Hanahan's displays these weapons and gets up and says, Fred Hampton opened fire at the police from the back bedroom. And the cop said, yeah, I found Fred Hampton dead in the bed, and the .45 caliber was right next to his right hand. Well, while they were saying that on TV, I was interviewing the fiancée of Fred Hampton in the police lockup.
Who was very pregnant at the time with Fred's child.
8.5 months pregnant. And she said that the police came in firing, that Fred never really woke up, and when they pulled her out of the room, they walked in and they fired two bullets into Fred Hampton's head and said, one of them at first said, is he dead? And then she said, I heard two shots. And the other one said, he's good and dead now. So her version was totally different. And while I was doing that, my partners, Skip Andrew and Flint Taylor, were actually at the apartment looking at the physical evidence with a filmographer, with somebody filming the apartment as they walked in. I've always been amazed that my partner Skip Andrew had the presence of mind in the face of this to go and gather evidence with a filmmaker and a minister documenting everything that they picked up. They saw that the bullets in the apartment came from this where the police came from and converged in the area of the Panthers and in particular at Fred Hampton's bed. You can tell a bullet entry from an exit in a wall, and I learned a great deal about firearms identification in the process of this case, but it makes a smaller hole, and of course the wood is splayed outward where the bullet exits the wall as opposed to where it enters the wall. So we very quickly examined the walls and got a firearms expert there. And it turned out that every shot except one was fired by the police. And the one shot by a Panther was fired by a Panther, Mark Clark, who was killed, came from his shotgun, and most likely it was after he was shot, because the shot goes almost straight up in the air. It wouldn't be a shot that you, if you were shooting at someone, you wouldn't have shot with that kind of angle. It was almost as he was falling, his weapon fired. So the police had their version, which they stuck to, and we had the physical evidence and our client's version. But Hanrahan was so anxious to convince the public that his version was right that he gave photographs to the Tribune and said, this is the evidence that Fred Hampton fired. Here are the bullet holes right next to the back door. And he had this big exclusive in the Chicago Tribune. The entire front page was the police version of the raid. And so the other papers were not too pleased that Hanrahan gave the exclusive to the Tribune. So we said, come on out here and we'll show you what those holes in the back door are. And in fact, those holes were nail holes. There were no bullet holes in the back door.
Yeah, little nail holes, and the heads of the nails were clearly apparent.
Right. So all of a sudden, Hanrahan, at his next press conference, he was confronted. Well, what about those pictures you gave us? Well, I made no representation about the pictures, he said. I don't know what they were supposed to be. And he basically tried to waffle around the fact that his and the police story had come undone when reporters went to the apartment.
One of the creepiest things in the book is a photograph of the police taking Fred Hampton's body out of the house. They're all smiling joyously. It's really scary to look at.
Well, you talk about a document, a picture that tells 1,000 words. And it turned out a Chicago Daily News reporter had the night beat, and he was riding around and heard the police call, and he photographed the police carrying Fred's body out of the apartment. And indeed, they are smiling. And not only are they smiling, when we got the radio tape of when the police called in what had happened to the Wood Street station, the nearest district, there was a roar of applause from the unit, and the response of the police was, Panthers kill police, police kill Panthers. And that was the spontaneous response of the police when they heard that Fred Hampton was dead.
What happened that night turned into a series of court cases that lasted more than a decade. I have to say, one of the tip-offs as I was reading it, because I didn't know the story before I read the book, was that the police didn't even seal the apartment.
A very unusual circumstance, and we've always wondered why that was. Was it they were afraid of community retaliation? Was it the guilt of people who knew they had just carried out an assassination and they wanted to get out of there? It's really kind of amazing. Was it that they didn't want the physical evidence to be recovered in a way that it could be offered in court, so they didn't gather it? I mean, one of the strange things, in addition to leaving the apartment unsealed, was the police, rather than picking up and marking where different bullet shells, shell casings, the guns themselves were found, they just took everything they found and threw it in a bag and took it to the state's attorney's office. They were so glad or so happy to display it that they found all these weapons, that and they thought that would be enough. And I think Hanrahan assumed that, look, these are Black Panthers, we found weapons there, end of story. Whatever the police had to do was justified. It never washed in the Black community. The Black community said, but this is a 21-year-old kid who was killed in his bed. Many of the Black community did not agree with the Panthers in their program and their militancy, and some did. But there was almost uniform opposition to the raid in the Black community and among liberals and among people who began to look at the physical evidence.
So after that, what happened? The survivors were at first going to be prosecuted. The survivors of the police attack were themselves charged with something.
All the survivors were prosecuted and charged with attempted murder. And it was based on the police story that as they entered the apartment, one of the survivors, Brenda Harris, was sitting on a couch and calmly fired 2 shotgun blasts at them as they came in the front door. And the evidence that they said they had to support that were 2 shotgun shells, which they claimed they found in the living room of the apartment, that they said matched the gun, the Panther weapon, that was in Brenda Harris's hands. When the FBI, who in some ways did a good investigation and in another way were completely covering up the FBI role, When the FBI firearms examiner looked at those two shells, he said, no, those were not from a Panther weapon. Those were, in fact, from a police shotgun that was carried. And, of course, the amazing thing is there was no bullet holes or shot holes from the shotgun blast. So the entire police case was based on physical evidence that turned out to be a mismatch. In fact, it was more than a mismatch. The crime lab basically altered their results to justify the police accounts.
So what happened next?
What happened next? With that exposure, the charges against the survivors were dropped. Hanrahan and his raiders were actually indicted for obstructing justice, for lying about what happened. But they went to a Cook County judge who was part of the machine, as Hanrahan was, and he acquitted them. And then we sued the raiders for the damage to the survivors. We brought a civil rights suit in 1970.
Now, this was a big change for you because you had been there running the People's Law Office and basically working with municipal and state laws. This was a federal, it was a whole new area of law for you and for the lawyers you were working with.
We had done mostly criminal defense, keeping the movement people out of jail, and that was our main job, which mostly involved state charges. To bring a civil suit in a whole court system that we weren't used to was very daunting to us. We got a lot of help from the National Lawyers Guild, and they sent in people like Arthur Kanoy and Bill Kunstler to tell us, you could do it, we did it in the South, and we did it, and we did it with their help.
It was a strange moment for you before you started the civil suit when all these charges against them were dropped.
Right. We didn't understand exactly why they were dropped. Now, we knew the physical evidence didn't support it, but it seemed like there was something else going on. We learned later that the feds made a deal with Hanrahan, and the deal was, Hanrahan, you drop the charges against the survivors, and we won't indict you on any federal charges. And in the middle of our civil trial, we actually uncovered what we call the deal document, and it states, by Jairus Leonard, the head of the grand jury, we don't intend to indict anybody, but we want you to drop the charges. What we didn't know then was, well, why was the FBI so willing to make this deal? And, of course, what we learned later was it was the FBI who had provided Hanrahan with the floor plan that they used in the raid. We never knew about this floor plan. We never knew that it was the officer in Chicago working with COINTELPRO who got his informant, William O'Neill, to draw him a floor plan of the apartment showing even where Fred Hampton slept. And in fact, when you trace the bullet holes, they converged on the bed where the floor plan showed Fred Hampton would be sleeping. It took us 5 years of litigation to get that document. Probably a state's attorney we know the state's attorney who turned it over to us was expected to destroy it, but didn't. He lost his job shortly after.
He lost his job shortly after for basically not destroying evidence.
Exactly, exactly. You know, a lot of times you wonder why the FBI just doesn't destroy all their documents, and so you never get any incriminating evidence. Well, it's difficult to do under the FBI system. Every document that's written not only has a number, but gets circulated into maybe 10 files across the country. The Panther file in Washington, the Panther file in Chicago, the Fred Hampton file in each place. So, and each one and every document indicates where it's routed. So it's not as simple as going into the Chicago file and pulling that document, because if the D.C. file shows that not only the document exists, but it should be in the Chicago file, then somebody's obviously pulled it. So most documents are preserved. The floor plan was the only document I've ever seen. They only made one copy of it. It was put in the do not file file.
The do not file file. We're talking to Jeffrey Haas. He is author of the book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. One of the very interesting things about reading this book is seeing how much difference a judge makes. And in this case, you got a judge who was totally biased toward the police and the FBI, biased against Black Panthers and indeed probably a lot of civil rights movements, and one of the results of that was you couldn't even get evidence, which you had the legal right to see.
The judge, a lot in these civil rights cases, it's about what they call discovery, which is getting the documents, the internal documents of the police department or the FBI, and of course also taking the depositions of the FBI agents and the police. In this case, this judge, first of all, he dismissed our case early on, and so we had to get it reinstated. And after we did, he attempted to block our discovery, particularly around the FBI's involvement. And even though it had come out in kind of an interesting thing, there was a burglary in Pennsylvania, in Media, Pennsylvania, of an FBI office by an anti-war movement, I think, around the draft. And they uncovered COINTELPRO in 1971. It was secret. And so they circulated those documents. And so even though we knew there was a program that targeted the black movement that talked about disrupting, destroying, neutralizing the Black Panthers and its leaders, preventing coalitions of those groups, the FBI said, well, that program had nothing to do with this raid. And then somewhat by luck, I guess, the key informant in this case became involved in a murder operation and had to become a witness for the state. And in the course of that, his name was William O'Neill. He admitted that he had been a FBI informant in the Panthers and had actually been Fred Hampton's bodyguard.
And you knew him.
I knew him personally, and that was very strange to be see him years later face to face and know that he had made this floor plan, in fact, that had shown where Fred would be sleeping. And O'Neill was not just, you know, sometimes you think of an informant as sort of the silent, quiet guy who sits in the corner and takes down everything that happens. O'Neill was a provocateur. O'Neill was the one who said the Panthers should build an electric chair so that people who were informants would be afraid to join the party. He was the guy that wanted to build a rocket that could go from the Panther office to City Hall. So he was the one who engaged, in fact, the most provocative acts. And also he was involved in criminal activity the whole time that he was in the party. So he really was a perfect sort of double agent. He was not passive. He was ingenious. And I also think he was almost schizophrenic because he could get into the role of the informant and wanting to be an FBI agent, and he could also get into the role of a Panther. And one of the things he did, I think, that from a psychological standpoint is the hardest to understand is the morning after Fred Hampton was killed, and that after he knew that he had given a floor plan showing where Fred Hampton would be sleeping to the FBI, William O'Neill goes to Fred Hampton's mother crying and says, could I be a pallbearer in Fred's funeral? And you could say, well, this is a great smart move to make it look like he's in the cover, but I think he actually believed both things. He had the ability to be sympathetic, sad about Fred's death, and at the same time plot it.
Multiple personality.
Absolutely.
So he was one of the characters, and I have to say that reading this book, it's in a way almost, it's a combination of luck and incredible attention to detail, to facial expressions, to intuition, knowing when somebody's lying, when somebody just says a few words too fast, that gives you an idea that maybe he's lying and so you have to look at something else. I mean, you were making virtually no money on this. You and your colleagues continued at it while the other side, the defense, had just immeasurable amounts of cash and teams of lawyers to throw at it. You had a judge who was hostile toward you and sympathetic toward them. So basically, money, power, the judge, the system were all on their side, and you just kept going.
Well, I think we did, and I think one of the ironies was I think we had been very moved and inspired by Fred Hampton. So I think that memory was alive when we were pursuing his killers in the civil rights case. Somehow, sometimes when things look so bad, we'd think, well, what would Fred do? Would he give up? And one of Fred's slogans was, you know, dare to struggle, dare to win. If you don't fight for peace, you don't deserve peace. And that was sort of his position, you know. You have to put yourself out there. You have to commit to something. You have to take the risks that are inherent in that. And so frequently when we were down, and there were plenty of moments when we were down, when the case got thrown out of court, a third of the way through the trial, when the defendants had been denying, saying we got every document that existed on the Panthers and Fred Hampton, and they made a mistake in which exposed that at least one document existed that they hadn't gotten. And even this judge, for just a moment, was a little upset and said, well, no, bring in all the documents. And a third of the way through the trial, they brought in 200 volumes of documents on shopping carts that had supposedly been produced before the trial that were in fact produced then.
And then you were supposed to read them, deal with them, and so on
in the middle of the trial.
15 minutes.
Right. I mean, as the trial went on, we were supposed to read and categorize and figure out how to use all these documents. And there were some amazing documents we got, one of which we call the bonus document. Because the federal government had always claimed, well, yes, Hanrahan and the police acted improvidently. They didn't plan the raid well, and they should have done this or that. They never acknowledged that they might have gone in there with the intent to murder Fred Hampton. And they sort of played we're the neutral arbiter. We're the ones who examine the physical evidence and decide who fired what shots. What they never told the public was they were the ones behind the whole thing. It was they went to Hanrahan and said, why don't you raid this place? There are weapons there, and here's a floor plan.
And basically, why don't you kill Fred Hampton? Was that part of it?
Well, I mean, whether that was explicit or implicit, you know, they knew Hanrahan was ambitious. They knew that he had declared this war on gangs. So, you know, whether they told him, of course, Fred Hampton was there and where he slept, and, you know, whether in those meetings, how explicit you have to be. Of course, they deny that they planned anything other than the execution of a search warrant, but why the machine gun and the shotguns and the rifle. Other raids had been carried out, in which one raid was carried out at the Panther office. They called the office and said, we got you surrounded. Don't resist. And the Panthers opened the door and let him in. Other cases, they had used bullhorns or other things. So they didn't come. If they had wanted to either seize the weapons, there were ways to do that without storming the doors and opening fire, which is what they did.
So this case drags on and on, and a jury, which was chosen in a way that was not great for your side, and it was not chosen as impartially as it should have, the jury heard all of this and finally could not come to a unanimous decision.
Right. They could not, and we weren't surprised because everybody was divided by it. The judge also gave them instructions, which if they had followed, would have made it impossible to find for our clients. He basically said, if you find that the Panthers had weapons in their apartment, or because of their rhetoric, then the police were justified in killing them, even if they never picked up a gun. So he tried to skew the trial in a way that the jury would have to decide for the defendants. When he failed, and this was after 18 months of trial, of being in court every day, he decided to take things into his own hands, and he decided to dismiss the case himself while the jury was still deliberating. So we talk about down moments. After so many years of litigation and so forth, here we are faced with We've been dismissed from court. Costs against our clients have been assessed at $100,000, and we're supposed to put up $100,000 just to appeal his ruling. So that's where we were after 10 years. And you talk about
10 years.
Yeah, that's where we were pretty close to rock bottom at that point. But the rest of the story is sort of like our comeuppance.
The story of your case is a long one, and it's finally resolved in a way that you're vindicated, but I'm not going to say any more about it right now because people will just have to take a look at the book, read the book themselves. When you look at this whole case and all the issues and the huge legal battle that you fought, you won after all this time. In the big picture, what really was won, and how did it move our civil rights forward in the United States?
Well, you know, there's only so much you can do if you're a civil rights lawyer. You don't have the power to prosecute someone criminally. So all you can do is sue, you can expose what happened, and maybe you can get some damages. I will say that the exposures that we helped cause by talking about the evidence, explaining that it wasn't a shootout, but it was a shoot-in, and the black community started going through the place, and within a few days, hundreds and thousands of black people had walked through the apartment. The Panthers actually led these things. As I said, the black community did not accept Hanrahan's version from the get-go. And it was the beginning of a sort of independent black political movement in Chicago. And blacks and liberal whites formed a coalition which ultimately elected Harold Washington, Chicago's first black mayor. So politically, this case had tremendous repercussions in terms of up until this point, most of the black alder people and even the congressmen were totally beholden to the Daley machine. After this, they said no, and in fact, they created a whole liberal wing that actually won in the case of Harold Washington. Some people argue that had it not been for that, that the party would not have been liberal enough that Obama would have ever been slated by them and supported by them. So there is that very clear political line here. In terms of civil rights law, I think we did establish that the conspirators don't necessarily have to meet together. The FBI, who gives the floor plan to Hanrahan, don't have to meet with the guys who walk in with the guns. But I think it's an ongoing issue, the issue of abuse by intelligence agencies. One of the things I uncovered here was that we were also very fortunate in that the Church Committee, while we were litigating, was investigating the Watergate break-ins. The country, the public, was outraged to find out that the White House was calling for burglaries at the Democratic headquarters and of Richard Ellsberg. So there was this Church Committee set up that actually put on, said there should be oversight of intelligence committees and there should be, the Freedom of Information Act should apply to them. The two people in the Ford administration who opposed that were a guy named Donald Rumsfeld and his sidekick Dick Cheney, who was his aide. So from the beginning, they have always wanted an executive power without branch, without limit, without check, and intelligence agencies. And so we see that, of course, in the Bush administration, these men having their day, basically, and an executive unlimited by the Constitution. So I think it's an ongoing struggle about, can we use the courts, the civil rights, to expose and stop government abuse? And I think it's still alive today because the torturers at Guantanamo and so forth have still not been prosecuted.
Meanwhile, Fred Hampton was not the only black man, black leader to be assassinated.
No, he was not. And I think what's perhaps, I don't know about unique, but I think this is probably the most well-documented case of a political assassination. There's certainly a lot of questions about how Dr. King died. There are a lot of questions about Malcolm X died. Why did his FBI informant, Guardi Guard, not be there that night? You know, and then been other blacks killed in numerous situations with the police. I think what's interesting here is one of the documents we got was a bonus document, we called it. And they gave the informant O'Neill a bonus because the information he gave in the floor plan was invaluable to the success of the raid. So here we have the FBI setting up the raid, going over there the same morning to find out what happened, and then internally saying our informant should get a bonus because we were the ones who made this happen, and internally congratulating themselves.
The book is The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered a Black Panther. It's tremendously gripping, riveting. What did you do after that, after all of this was over? What was the nature of your legal work, and what happened to the People's Law Office?
I think in the course of that trial, I guess if you take an 18-month trial, it's like 10 normal trials, I think we became pretty much experts in civil rights litigation, civil litigation. So we bought several important lawsuits against the police. We were the office that uncovered this police torturer named John Burge in Chicago, who was torturing black suspects. We sued him. Again, it was Flint and me with another one of our partners, John Stainthorpe. And it turned out that our client was not the only one who was tortured. Other people were. And when I say torture, I mean torture with electroshock, torture with bagging. They used a thing called dry submarino. Unlike waterboarding, you put a typewriter bag over somebody's head until they pass out. But it's the same principle. They think they're going to die. This was being used in Chicago police stations.
Against exclusively black
suspects, right. And many of these people ended up giving confessions, and then when this was exposed, their murder convictions were overturned, and it played a very large role in Governor Ryan commuting all the death sentences in Chicago, in Illinois.
I think that another very important lesson from this book is the importance of the media. When the newspapers were there, when you had competing newspapers trying to scoop each other, that did a lot for your case.
It really did, and that's a good point, because now there aren't competing newspapers, and even the ones that there's not a lot of investigative reporting going on. And there were some real reporters with real conscience who came to the apartment early on and saw there was a misfit between Hanrahan and the police stories and the physical evidence, and were not afraid to report it. Some actually were so angry that their papers, one of them did a detailed story early, and when it ended up on page 59, he quit because he said, "This, you know, Hanrahan's story is on page one of the Tribune. Why is mine on page 59 of the Chicago Daily News?" But there were some very conscientious reporters. Chicago reporters, John Kiffner of the New York Times, did a real good job. The Chicago Defender had good coverage. Generally, when we would get material that was about government misconduct, the press was willing to print it.
There's a very important question that the story of Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers raises, which is the question that probably every Black activist in the 60s and 70s had to address, which is, are you going to go the Dr. Martin Luther King path of nonviolence, or are you going to take up arms to what a lot of people considered simply to defend themselves?
That certainly was an issue, and I guess to some extent we can look at it today, or we can look at it from what people saw in 1969, which was a history of civil rights struggles in the South, which had gotten many laws changed. And as a matter of fact, many people say the whole purpose of the civil rights movement in the North was to get liberal congressmen and senators to pass the Public Accommodations Act, the Voter Registration Act, and so forth. But it didn't deal with the problems in the northern cities. And in the mid-60s, you had huge urban riots in Watts, in Detroit, in New Jersey, in Newark, and in many of these metropolises, because blacks were angry, and the civil rights movement didn't really change their lives very much. And so all portions of the movement, from SNCC and SCLC and everybody, said, we got to come north and deal with the situation in these big industrial cities or in California. The Panthers were one answer to that, and one of the issues they had to face was police brutality. And they said they believed in what they called armed self-defense, at least that was their rhetoric. There was a lot of rhetoric back then that I'm not sure the people speaking it knew it or understood it completely or endorsed it. The Panthers would say off the pig meant getting police that were oppressing and beating people in the community out of the community. To the cop, that might have meant I'm a target of the Panthers. So some rhetoric was understood one way and another way. I don't know that the Panthers were totally for armed struggle. They were for armed self-defense, and they did carry weapons. And they did talk in a very rhetorical way about using guns. Power comes from the barrel of a gun. So in that sense, looking back, we can say that was maybe self-destructive. On the other hand, you looked around the world, how were people winning their freedom? The South Africans had attempted nonviolent means, and it was only violence that was the only thing they had that they could do, because every public meeting was outlawed. You looked at Vietnam, you looked at Cuba, you looked around the world, and the success of struggles against oppression was done basically through armed struggle, as it was by this country.
The American Revolution.
Absolutely. England did not say, okay, your cause is just, you can have your independence. It took people fighting to do it. So I think it's a complicated issue. I think you have to look at it at what the people saw at the time, what hadn't succeeded thus far, and the idea of people armed to defend themselves against the police made sense when there was no other check on the police at that time. So on the other hand, obviously, the state and the police have a lot more power than public revolutionaries who talk about picking up the gun. So I think it's a complicated issue, and I guess, you know, and under those circumstances, it probably resulted in the death of Fred Hampton. Although there was a program to get Fred Hampton, not just because he talked about guns, I think that may have given them an excuse. He really was talking about youth and organizing people to empower themselves and take over their communities. And that was a big threat to the police and to the status quo.
Jeff Haas, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, the assassination of Fred Hampton, how the FBI and the Chicago police murdered a Black Panther. And once again, he will be reading on January 15th at 7 o'clock at the Mabel Dodge Lujan House in Taos. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can find us at santafe.radiocafe.org, the website. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.